and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet, online and on KBIA. I'm Ruben Stern. It's no secret that the news media are undergoing a rapid transformation. Over the past decade, technology has transformed nearly every aspect of the news business, including the way people like you prefer to get your daily fix of news and information. Along the way, though, the news about the news has not necessarily been good. At least 15,000 journalists have left the newspaper industry, not to mention television and radio newsrooms. By 2009, daily newspapers in America had cut more than $1.5 billion a year out of their editorial spending. Online startups have picked up some of the slack, but overall, there's just a lot of local news not getting covered. At least that's the basic premise of a 365-page report released over the summer by the Federal Communications Commission. This week, the author of that report, along with a group of other big journalistic thinkers, will be part of a public meeting in Columbia to discuss the report's findings and consider how federal policy changes might help the situation. For example, is there a financial role that government could play in supporting local journalism? Could changes in tax policy or new government rules keep more reporters on the job? And what about making information easier for people like you to access? Today on our program, we'll have our own little discussion about the future of local news. With us in the studio are two of the organizers of the gathering this week. First, Barbara Cochran holds the Curtis B. Hurley Chair in Public Affairs Journalism at the Missouri School of Journalism. She is a former president of the Radio Television Digital News Association. Welcome to the studio, Barbara Cochran.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Also with us is Amy McCombs. She holds the Lee Hills Chair in Free Press Studies at the Missouri School of Journalism. She has a broad experience in the media and higher education and nonprofit sectors. Welcome to our program, Amy McCombs.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We also have with us Renee Graham. She is a public communications officer for the City of Columbia, and in that role, she sees firsthand some of the challenges in getting public information out to the community. Welcome to the program, Renee
Graham. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have all three of you with us. Yeah. We also hope that you and our audience will participate in the conversation as well. How would you rate the quality of local news that you get, and what would you like to get that you don't? Give us a call at 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And let's start with this question. Barbara, I just gave some scary statistics. But, you know, we turn on the television, we turn on the radio, there's still news there. What's the problem?
Well, what the report found, and I actually brought a copy of the report with me. There were not very many copies printed. It's mostly available online. But as you can see, it looks kind of like a telephone book for a pretty good-sized city. That's how big it is. And it's
about an inch and a quarter thick.
Yes, exactly. You said 360 pages plus 104 pages of footnotes. It's quite it's not something you can read in one sitting, I don't think. But one of the things that the report said was that, in a way, this is the best of times and the worst of times, that there is a there's both a breathtaking media abundance that lives side by side with serious shortages in reporting. And so what we're seeing is a whole lot of information that's available, especially at the national level, but at the local level, increasingly, what we consider investigative or accountability journalism has diminished seriously. The reporting strength is just not there. People who are covering government meetings, looking at the schools, looking at social services. And so that's what this report is worried about, and I think that's what we hope to address at the symposium tomorrow.
Now, Amy, maybe you can help us with this. Why would the FCC be doing a report like this? What's their stake in all of this?
Well, they're at a critical point in the whole information highway, if you will, in for the 21st century. First of all, they have a responsibility for television, radio, phone, internet, parts of the cable industry. So the whole digital environment really they have a lot of responsibility for, by law, by Congress legislating their level of responsibility. In 2008, there was a report released about information needs of communities, and it looked at information in the broadest sense, including libraries, education, places where the public can access and organizations providing information. When the FCC looked at that, they saw their responsibility, and they asked themselves a couple questions. You know, they wanted to know whether or not people were getting the information they needed in the 21st century. And more importantly, were the regulations, the policies, the guidelines meeting the expectations of the public and also the needs of the public. So because of their responsibility, they undertook this, their own study, which they've just completed and released this summer.
Right. And Renee, how does this fit with your observation of the landscape here in mid-Missouri?
Well, certainly it is a lot more difficult to figure out how to reach citizens because it is so fragmented where people get their information. And we all have such very busy lives. That combined with the fact that there aren't as many there aren't as many sources for covering city government in particular. So for us, how do we get the message out to citizens when some of our partners are diminishing and we don't have as many outlets for getting that news coverage that the citizens deserve?
Right. Again, for those of you in our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the future of local news. Joining me in the studio are Barbara Cochran, who holds the Curtis B. Hurley Chair in Public Affairs Journalism at the Missouri School of Journalism, Amy McCombs, who holds the Lee Hills Chair in Free Press Studies at the Missouri School of Journalism, and Renee Graham, a Public Communications Officer for the City of Columbia. For those of you in our audience, how do you think local news outlets could improve their coverage? What are they not giving you that you wish you got? Share your thoughts by giving us a call at 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. I'd also like to remind you that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can join our online chat at that time by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Why this conversation here? What's going on that makes this a timely and relevant conversation to have?
I think the report looked at the national picture and had all of this rich detail. Now it's time to take it down to the local level and see exactly how these ideas might apply. And there are a number of recommendations that could be applied at the local level. This includes greater use of what are called PEG channels, the public, educational, and government channels, of which this program will be appearing on one of those. Can those play a greater role in filling the information gap? What kind of government or philanthropic support could be made available for nonprofit media? One of the speakers that we'll hear from tomorrow is a founder of the St. Louis Beacon, which is a website that was created in St. Louis to fill what was perceived as a gap in the reporting on that city. There's also public broadcasting, public radio like KBIA, public television. What kind of roles can those play? Because KBIA is actually unusual in that it does a lot of local reporting. Not all public radio and television stations across the country do that. And so there are lots of ways in which this can apply to the local community, and we're going to look at that right here in Missouri.
One of the things that is unique about Columbia and the University of Missouri Journalism School is that we have local media here that are very engaged. We have a morning newspaper. There's two morning newspapers. We have an NBC affiliate that's associated, obviously, owned by the state. And the journalism school is in KBIA, and the journalism school is involved with all those entities. One of the recommendations is looking at that, the role of journalism schools in the future, so providing these gaps in the news content. But we also have other innovation here in Columbia, and Barbara and I were excited with this project because it's going to let us showcase for the East Coast and the West Coast of the country what's going on here. This is part of a dialogue that's taking place this fall across 12 different university journalism schools, kicked off in October at Arizona State, and it's continuing. And these journalism schools were asked by Carnegie Foundation and the Knight Foundations to undertake this dialogue with their local communities. They're bringing this 350-page report down to the local level. Sometimes it's very hard with Washington. And so this is what we're going to be doing tomorrow. And we have a chance to show not only exciting things at KBIA, like the show we're on right now that is using digital media. KOMU has a new show at 4 o'clock using social media. But also the city and the university are involved in an exciting project called Gig.U, which is really expand. The goal is to expand broadband access throughout the community. In 2 days, the state of Missouri is having a summit on broadband across the state, so there's innovation going on there. And the university itself has the Mizzou Advantage and its own innovation and initiatives to encourage entrepreneurship and innovation in this sort of digital media area. So there's a lot going on here that is happening every day here in mid-Missouri that is actually addressing some of the issues and solutions that have been recommended in the report.
So. Right. Now, Amy, you mentioned GigU. What is that all about? Renee, do you have some information on that or what?
Well, GigU is a partnership started with universities. Certainly the university was a beginning partner, a charter member of GigU. Duke and universities in Michigan, Indiana, I mean, so many different universities participate in this. City government is partnering with the University of Missouri and local provider Mornet to help participate in this project. There were some financial commitments made to help explore what do we need to get ultra-high-speed internet to Columbia, to our community. You know, businesses and academic institutions are sharing huge amounts of data daily back and forth. And if we can figure out a way to partner and provide ultra-high speed at a much more affordable and more easily accessible manner, then that certainly from an economic development point of view makes Columbia a more desirable location for maybe an entity, a research facility or a business to want to locate here in Columbia. Mm. It also helps nurture academic research that's already going on in our community and supports businesses who are already doing important work here and gives them some resources to expand and continue being successful here in Columbia.
And the goal is to bring it to every doorstep.
Right.
Right now, universities, businesses, some neighborhoods might have it. Within 10 minutes of where we're sitting right now in Boone County, there are people that do not have access to high-speed internet and these huge pipelines that not only will make their lives easier, but also help address some of the questions that we're talking about today, information mm-hmm. needs. For example, newspapers used to send reporters down to cover all the city council meetings and committee meetings, and that doesn't happen, but the city government is broadcasting that, putting those things on the internet. The public school system is doing that. But if you don't have that pipeline to your home, you do not have access to that content, that information, and therefore the transparency of government isn't as available to you. So, this is an exciting initiative there that is the fact that a university communities have identified it as an opportunity. They're working together, which even makes it, I think they're over 30 communities. So just that partnership and networking together can open up huge, huge potential innovation. And again, looking to the 21st century, I think in the report, Steve Wallman talks about broadband access as being absolutely critical to media innovation.
Steve Wallman's the author of the report,
of the report. He'll be joining us tomorrow and as our keynoter. So it's an opportunity to hear him. He's done a phenomenal job in this report and looking at this information ecosystem, I like to call it.
And what are the implications for the news organizations in terms of if everybody had access to high-speed internet in an easy way? I mean, how would that change the news?
Well, I think one of the things that you get with high-speed internet is better video. And so I think that would be very advantageous for news organizations that are producing video. And what we're seeing is that differences between newspapers and television and radio are rapidly disappearing because newspapers now put video on their website. Radio stations put video on their website. And so to be able to see that really wonderful high-quality video is very important. The other thing it does is that it gets citizens engaged in the news-gathering process because citizens can now provide video or information from wherever they are, which can be really interesting. I mean, almost any disaster that's happened recently, Joplin is one example. Some of the very earliest visuals that you got were from regular folks who took their video camera out and were able to transmit it because of the pipes that go between homes and media organizations, and then the media organizations back out to homes are getting bigger and bigger.
Right.
I think one of the other things that it will do for media organizations is change their perspective, because the question is, how do you define a community now? And this shows a good example. I believe KBIA covers about 17 counties, so if it was just purely over the air, that would be your community. Mm-hmm. Now you're online. Your audience is global. So it's, you know, you can begin to define your areas of what community means. So it can be geographic, it could be topic driven, interest driven, and all of a sudden it opens up, I think, a rich opportunity for news organizations then to take that environment and then drive it home to their local market.
But how do you deal with local in that sense? I mean, if KBIA starts to refocus its content around things that are not just that 16 county area, what becomes of local news? How does that still fit the word local in that case?
Well, I don't think you're doing that. I can't imagine KBIA would do that. But all of a sudden, you know, KBIA begins to have impact in other places in the country, other places in the world. It allows it to engage those people back into the local community too. You know, audiences. And I, you know, I'm involved here at the journalism school and with KBIA with the Global Journalist, which we produce locally for a local market. But we have guests from all over the world and bring that perspective. We could not have done that without the internet and the digital age. And I think there's example after example. It's sort of, I think all good media operations, and I think KBIA is one, KOMU, and the Missourian, think of their local audience, their local consumer first. But that person doesn't live within a 17-county universe.
There's also, I mean, you can develop expertise because of your location that would be very valuable to someone living somewhere else. One example is KBIA, as you well know, is a partner in the Harvest Public Media Consortium, which is located here in the Midwest, and that is a group of Midwestern-based public radio stations that have compiled a huge amount of deep reporting, deep information about...
There are a couple of television stations in the mix there.
Right,
as well.
Right, exactly, that are... and it's all available online. And so that information, which certainly has local relevance, is also... very important for everybody all across the country. You know, anybody who eats or uses fuel is going to be interested in the work that Harvest Public Media is doing. So I think that's a way you can have it both ways.
Well, I'd like to just kind of talk about video, and we were talking about the need for broadband. You know, a lot of communities now are using a lot more GIS. The geographic information systems that are reliant on technology. And for example, we've just launched a City View map. And the City View map really takes information regarding everything from maps, regarding boundaries, planning and zoning, who's your representative, what are the snow routes, what are the solid waste pickup routes. A variety of things that we're pulling together to make available information available by mapping technology, natural resources inventory, so we can track what's our canopy look like over the next 2 years, 5 years, 20 years. And I'll just put in a plug that there's a Geographic Information System Day on Wednesday, November 16th from 3 to 5.
Yep.
And there will be representatives from Boone Electric, the University of Missouri, the Columbia Career Center. They'll be doing demonstrations and showing how citizens can now use this mapping technology to get incredible, you know, very interactive information. Mm-hmm. And again, if you don't have access to that pipe and have the access to be able to get good quality internet service, A citizen will miss out on that opportunity.
And why is the city doing that? Is this required of the city, or is it just something that somebody decided, let's do this, it'll be great?
You know, the city government is responsible to citizens' need for information. And there is a greater expectation of easily accessible information, a greater expectation of transparency, a greater expectation of, you know, instant communication. And so the onus is upon us to do what we can to take all of this myriad of information and data that we have scattered all throughout the city organization and try to get our hands wrapped around it into a format that is valuable not just to city government and decision makers and policy makers, but is easily accessible and relevant to people's everyday lives.
Okay, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the future of local news. Joining me in the studio are Barbara Cochran, who holds the Curtis B. Hurley Chair in Public Affairs Journalism at the Missouri School of Journalism, Amy McCombs, who holds the Lee Hills Chair in Free Press Studies at the Missouri School of Journalism, and Renee Graham, a Public Communications Officer for the City of Columbia. For those of you in our audience, how have your own news habits changed over the past few years, and what changes might you like to see in the kind of news you get? Share your thoughts. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Renee, you were talking about the city putting information out there, providing resources for people to be able to get it. How do you decide what information ought to be out there in a way that the public can get easily?
Well, we certainly know by tracking the questions that we get. Every department has their frequently asked questions. You know, it kind of goes back to that 80-20 rule that a lot of times, 80% of your questions are about 20% of your information. Tracking what is what we get requests for, what council asks for certainly helps tell us because they hear from their constituents. We can also track what's on our website, and that will really show us, you know, where are people going on our website and what can we do to improve our website, which is one of the things in terms of increased transparency. We're actually getting ready to do we're in the process of doing an overhaul of our website and really trying to improve the navigation, make it more intuitive, get rid of some of the clutter, and just try to get as much information easily accessible on the website as possible. So, again, it goes back to, you know, the need for Internet, trying to drive that information as well as possible.
Before we move on, I want to make a follow-up to your request to your listeners. And
yes.
I really hope people do either email or call in because we really – Barbara and I would love to take their questions or comments tomorrow to our symposium mm-hmm. because it's an open-to-the-public event, but we know that many, many people won't be able to attend. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that your Intersection audience sort of comes in here and gives us some ammunition that we can take into the meeting
I hope so.
And ask some good questions.
I hope so, too. We do have a question from our chat room. One of our – audience members ask, Barbara and Amy, you're involved in innovative media projects from coast to coast. What are some of the more exciting innovations that you've come across that sort of, quote, meet the needs of communities?
Well, one of the things we're going to showcase are things that are happening right here. And, Amy, do you want to talk about what KOMU is doing at the 4
No, absolutely.
With their 4
I think right
show?
In our own backyard is KOMU's 4 o'clock show. Which around the rest of the country, news television stations are looking at it, and its use of social media and engagement using new technology than Google's technology that is allowing groups and people to interconnect, and it's exciting. And Sarah Hill will be here tomorrow and talk about it. And I think in talking to them, they all say this is an experiment. This is something we're trying. We know we're out on the edge of some of this technology right now, but again, it's the point I made earlier, where it's helping to kind of change the definition of community. It's allowing both participants in the program, but also the viewers to participate, and also people online. So I think that's one that we're going to be showcasing that tomorrow. One of the things that I find exciting with the new technologies, and this goes to the use of mapping technologies, and I'll probably mispronounce this, but it's Yoshida, which I'm not pronouncing that correctly, But it started in Africa and in India. A very simple technology that allows the matching up of information and content to location in a very credible way. And so it was used, then adapted in Japan during the tsunami earthquakes and the nuclear disaster, because the citizens had more accurate information than the news media or the government had. And so very quickly, because it's a simple, sophisticated technology, but easy for anyone to use, they began to provide real-time, real information on the flooding, on the nuclear situation and radiation, on evacuation routes, et cetera. And it was put in place within hours. And again, so I think beginning to see examples like that where the technology is breaking down the barriers to entry. It used to be you had to have a $300 million printing facility to be in the information business. And now there's just a lot of opportunity, a lot of innovation going on. Will it all stick? I don't know. But that's what's exciting right now. I mean, I think an exciting time to be in the media business. And I don't think many of us would have said that 5 years ago.
Right. The point that Amy made is an excellent one, because gone are the days when a media organization could sit back and put out a publication or say, this is the time of our broadcast, and the audience, you know, had to show up at the schedule that the media organization had decided it was going to follow. And so you see the walls between organizations and the public just becoming more and more porous. And one of the innovations that we'll be showcasing tomorrow is something called Public Insight Network. Mm-hmm. This is something that was started by the public radio organization in the Twin Cities, Minnesota Public Radio. And actually, the Missouri School of Journalism is now a partner and is now helping to deploy it. And what this is a database of about, last I knew it was about 80,000, it's probably more than that now, people who are listeners to public radio stations who have signed up and volunteered to tell something about themselves, so that if a story should arise or if they want to propose that something be investigated, they can do that. One of the earliest examples of how this worked was when the bridge collapsed in Minneapolis during rush hour, and there was immediately speculation on most media that this must be terrorism. Somebody must have done something to cause that bridge to collapse. But because of the Public Insight Network, Minnesota Public Radio was able to tap into the expertise of structural engineers. They could do a search, find out who the engineers were, and those engineers said, we think it's something with the structure, and they were able to report the story accurately while others were still talking about terrorists.
Okay. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA, the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the future of local news. Joining me in the studio are MU professors Barbara Cochran and Amy McCombs, and City of Columbia Public Communications Officer Renee Graham. We'll be right back. Stick around. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the future of local news. Joining me in the studio are Barbara Cochran, who holds the Curtis B. Hurley Chair in Public Affairs Journalism at the Missouri School of Journalism, Amy McCombs, who holds the Lee Hills Chair in Free Press Studies at the Missouri School of Journalism, and Renee Graham, a Public Communications Officer for the City of Columbia. For those of you in our audience, what kind of news do you look for, and how easy is it for you to find it? Share your thoughts by giving us a call at 573-882-8925 or send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. You can also call in with any questions or comments that you have about our discussion. Again, the number 573-882-8925. We have a question from someone in our online chat room. Sarah asks, what does the report say about government advertising and its effect on local media? That's one of the recommendations in the report. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what they're recommending and what that would do. Right.
The you mentioned it at the in the opening of the program when you talked about the elimination of jobs, the cutback, and looking at what's happening across all media. And what Steve Wallman tried to do in the report is put a dollar figure around that to say how much investment in local news and accountability journalism has been taken out of the system, and that's really hard to do. But he put it in a range and below $1 billion to above $1 billion. He then said, okay, what do we need to do to fill that gap, to fill the news gap and how to pay for that gap and get us back with doing the kind of local journalism we think we need. So he began to look at a number of options, and one of them was turning to philanthropy and the not-for-profit sector. That was one. The other was to look at what's available currently within the government at the federal level. He didn't look at what's going on at the state levels. And he looked at a number of things, and one of the items that has been constantly reviewed by the General Accounting Office and others is the amount of money that the federal government spends on advertising. And that could be everything from, obviously, Department of Defense recruitment to the National Park Service to when the U.S. Census, alerts you that it's time now for your census. Almost every agency, every division of government spends money, and they estimated most recently it was well over $1 billion. So one of the suggestions is, and it has a lot of negative and positive attached to it, is this idea that looking at those dollars, is it possible that those dollars could be spent differently across local media and public and for-profit, not-for-profit and for-profit? Could it be spent in the area of digital, in other areas? Is there some way that could help fill this gap, the spending gap that has occurred over the last five to ten years? The money is spent nationally across national media. So that would be like ESPN, the Super Bowl, National Network, prime time, all the cable channels that you see. So that was the recommendation. Can we review that and take a look at having that money spent locally? And not necessarily on local for-profit media, but what is the best way to use those dollars that would, again, encourage more local coverage? But the caveat, and it was very clear when Steve wrote this as a recommendation, is that it has to be without any strings attached. And if you look around the world where press is under siege, one of the ways governments control media is through the dollars they spend in advertising. In Latin America, it's very common. A radio station, TV, newspaper can be put out of business because normal advertising dollars that have been spent by the government is pulled away. And, we have things like requirements by law that certain legal announcements are posted. A lot of that does happen locally, but I've been in markets where I've seen that dollar move because the mayor didn't like the newspaper's position on something, mm-hmm. and they move it to someplace else. So Steve was very clear that these dollars cannot have any one attachment for political points of view and rewarding your friends, or secondly, not benefit the advertising and marketing needs that the federal government has. So I think it's one we're going to be exploring here. I think that one of the great resources the Journalism School has is its research department and its strategic communications departments are very well nationally well thought of. So we're going to take a look about how is that money being spent? Is it being spent effectively? Is there a better, more efficient way with new technologies? And we have the president of the Television Bureau of Advertising going to be speaking directly to it because his job is to advocate for local electronic media, but feels that with today's technologies, you can make very effective targeted buys that would probably give more value to the federal government's marketing plan. So that's one of the recommendations.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller on the line. We'll come back to the advertising question a bit before we end the hour. But I want to bring our caller in, John from Columbia. John, are you with us?
I am. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for calling in and joining our discussion.
Very interesting topic. I do understand that budget limitations have required a change in the news departments of both the printed and the broadcast media, but I have a question, and it goes back to the simple definition of news. News seems to have gone through a metamorphosis to now it is nothing more than what I call a radio police blotter. And by that I mean the reporters seem to do nothing but to parrot the official press releases that government and private industry spokesmen put out. Now, I realize you can't have investigative reporting on every single story, but to me, journalism would make a great step back to progress if they would at least dedicate some cursory inquiry and verification on this media release information that is provided through their sources.
You're concerned about exactly the same thing that the FCC study was concerned about, that, you know, we're surrounded by media choice, and yet the underlying examination, what is called accountability reporting, is diminishing, and it goes a lot of it is precisely because we are losing the number of professional trained reporters that are employed at individual news organizations. We talked about the loss in newspapers of 15,000 journalists are no longer reporting, who were reporting as recently as 2 years ago. In local television, which I'm familiar with from my past experience, the situation is a little different. The number of employees hasn't declined as dramatically as it has at newspapers, but the number of hours of news that are being broadcast has increased dramatically. Most television stations, local television stations that are doing news, have expanded the number of hours without expanding the number of people. And unfortunately, to be able to do this, the reporters have to instead of one story that they might have been able to work on all day and make an extra call or two on, now they're being asked to turn out two or even three stories a day. And naturally, that's just going to be something where they're going to have to, you know, do it very quickly and move on to the next thing. So, yes, that's a very serious question. And, you know, where are the gaps going to be filled in? Well, one of the thoughts is that nonprofit media can help to fill that in through public broadcasting, through the nonprofit websites that are becoming more common. But how are those going to develop a sustainable model? So lots of questions, and we hope we'll come up with some answers at the symposium tomorrow.
Right. John, does that answer your question? I guess John's no longer with us, so I hope we did.
Yeah, let me just add to one of the things in mentioning public radio and here on KVIA. I mean, in one of our speakers tomorrow is Brian Baracco, who's the VP of News for Hearst, and they have stations from very large markets to very small, all geographically, and they're in very competitive markets. And if you look at KVIA and NPR in general, it's very serious about news. It does very good accountability reporting. It does a lot of, you know, what I call enterprise reporting. Not just, you know, it doesn't use press releases. And the audiences are growing. I mean, the audiences, and Brian will talk about this tomorrow, and he's in very competitive news markets and television markets. And he's very committed to quality, accountable journalism. And what happens is that's how you get audience, because the audiences are very smart. You know, they want the information. If it's not available for them, they'll try to find it. But I think NPR is an encouraging sign, and KBIA, I mean, which is one of the top stations in the country, demonstrates that when you do that solid, good quality information, accountability journalism, audiences do show up.
Renee, I'm curious about your viewpoint on this because you're the one sending out some of these press releases, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you respond to that when a member of the public says, you know, we don't want news that's just press releases sent out by government agencies?
Absolutely. And, you know, we would like some follow-up calls on some of our press releases, you know, that we understand. And, you know, our role is we have so much information to share. And it really is we view the media as a partner in, you know, kind of going through those and saying, okay, here are some things that we want to follow up on. And then being able to tell the story in a little bit more depth. Because, you know, a press release can only give the basics. And so if there's a really good story, that backstory, we depend on the media to help us tell the rest of that story. Or, you know, we're looking for our own avenues to tell the story. And you mentioned earlier that we have a lot of media in Columbia. We certainly do. And we are very fortunate in some ways that we have that kind of coverage because a lot of communities might not have as many outlets as we do. But it still is so fragmented that for us it's always how do we get the story out? And you had talked about you can't just put an advertisement in any longer and that's, you know, we're going to have this newscast on this date. Well, the same thing for us. We can't just put an ad in the newspaper or put out a public notice that you know, this public meeting is going to be held. It's for us looking for media partners on how do we tell that story and why is it important that the citizens become engaged.
But there are requirements that you advertise public meetings and things like that.
Right. Okay. But, you know, we need to reach beyond that. Our goal is to have citizens connected, informed, and engaged. And so the media is certainly a partner in helping us connect, inform, and hopefully tell people why they should engage and why they should get involved.
Right. Okay, we have another caller on the line. Joyce, are you with us?
Yes.
Okay, Joyce, thanks for calling in and joining the discussion today.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
This is an interesting piece. 40 years ago, I would have had a whole different response. But in that 40 years, I've traveled outside the U.S. And when you come home and look at your local news, you say, is that the way they're doing it? Huh, interesting. You know, when I'm traveling, I can't read the hometown newspaper, so I plug in on the Internet. And when they say to you, well, we'll only let you read 10 stories.
Mm-hmm.
That's ridiculous.
Okay.
That's news censoring. That's censoring my opportunity to read the news when I'm not even there, but I want to read about local hometown.
Okay. Let's let our panelists respond to that. What would you say to that? Is that the community not getting its needs met?
That's I think what she's referring to is the paywall that some publications are experimenting with. You know, when you get a newspaper at home, that's supported in two ways, by the advertising revenue that for the ads that appear in the newspaper, but also by your subscription dollars. When you go to a website, you might see ads, but you're not necessarily paying money. And so newspapers are really trying to solve that conundrum. How do they – because ad dollars for the web are less than a tenth of what they would be for the dollars for the paper publication. And, you know, so how are they going to replace that lost revenue, which supports the reporters who can do the kind of in-depth reporting that makes you want to come to the website or the publication? And it remains to be seen whether that kind of subscription for an online product is going to be the way to go or not. In England, that's been tried. Murdoch, with his British newspapers, has a paywall. The New York Times and the Wall Street Journal are doing it in this country, and everybody's watching to see what happens.
And the Columbia Tribune here in Columbia.
Joyce, they've put up a paywall also?
Right.
Oh, boy.
And
okay.
Joyce, is that what you're referring to, is the Tribune specifically?
That's certainly one of them. And I said about 15 years ago to newspapers doing this, tell me at the bottom of three paragraphs, we're glad you enjoyed reading this, you can get more in print.
Right.
And nobody took me up on that until the last couple of years, and I began seeing it in different parts of the U.S.
Yeah,
right.
That so some little cryptic thing. thing pops up in a different color and says, we're glad you are reading our print or our newspaper online. You can see more of the story in print.
Right.
Yep. That is the point where then I might come home and literally go down to the newspaper and say, I want to get such and so date newspaper because I need more of that story.
Right.
I might spend more time looking for the archival versions
right.
of some of it.
Okay, thanks, Joyce.
Just to shut me off, the other thing is you look at news differently when you come back from overseas. When you're reading the BBC, you're hearing it, seeing it online, and you're right there at the point of the operation. To read about the U.S. from the British or from BBC's viewpoint shows us in a whole different light.
Yeah.
And I think all of us on the local front describe and design because we think we know who we are. And we never ask the visitor, is this the way we are? Do you see us this way?
Yeah. Joyce, I want to give our panelists a chance to respond to that. I want to thank you very much for joining
the
conversation and calling
in. The air.
Terrific.
Okay,
thanks again.
No, I think she makes some very good points. And, you know, there's on a global basis, there are different patterns. In the U.S., print, particularly print, be it magazine or newspaper, predominantly supported by advertising, whereas in Europe, Southeast Asia, it's just the opposite, that people have been paying for subscriptions. And also, as you know, the BBC, you have a TV tax. And so there's a shift going on here because the Internet obviously started out and information was free. And that was, so we're in this sort of struggle with trying to figure out the models. But this issue of I think we are very parochial in the United States, and the media tends to be parochial also. I think we do not give that global perspective. I think this, and I think the more that people do travel, they see it. I think, but that's one of the great strengths now with the Internet and this digital involvement engagement that we're in. Now you have access to that, you know, no matter where you live, that you have that opportunity to see that coverage from a different perspective. And I'm sure, it's something that can be used in the schools, and there's a lot of other, I think, benefits from it. But I think it's one of the areas that concerns me where the media have been closing down their foreign, U.S. media have been closing down their foreign bureaus mm-hmm. Closing down, major important bureaus. And I'm concerned, and I think that point of just are we being a global citizen, how do we look at ourselves and how do we get the information globally that's important for us here in Columbia, Missouri to understand?
Right. One of the things the report points out is that a lot of metro newspapers that used to have reporters, even just in Washington, D.C. or in, state issues, reporters across states that have reporters in the Capitol covering what goes on and how it affects their community specifically, those numbers have gone way down as well as part of this trend.
Right. I live in Washington and to see the number of newspaper bureaus that have closed down in Washington, just one of the things that's happened is that congressional delegations that used to have a reporter who called on them regularly and visited them all the time, that doesn't happen anymore. There's nobody doing it. And I really worry about, who's playing the watchdog now.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about some more of the report. First, I just want to remind everyone this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're talking about the future of local news, and joining me in the studio are Barbara Cochran and Amy McCombs. Both of them are on the faculty at the Missouri School of Journalism. We also have with us Renee Graham, who is a public communications officer for the City of Columbia. We have lots of opportunity for you in the audience to join the conversation as well. One question for you, what ideas do you have for improving local news coverage? You can call in with your thoughts on that or anything else related to our discussion. The phone number here, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Now, this report from the FCC came out in June. I want to talk a little bit about the recommendations. But first, I just want to preface this. There was an article in Adweek when the report came out by a writer named Katie Bachman, and she says, somewhere along the way, the report evolved into a middle-of-the-road, politically balanced document that will have little effect on policy and keep controversy to a minimum. And the reason I bring that in is because the recommendations in the report, they're not specific to the FCC's own operations necessarily, and they're not, to a lot of people in journalism, they're potential solutions, but not all that earth-shaking in terms of, wow, this would completely upend media as we know it and create a whole new landscape. And so I just want to talk a little bit about the recommendations in that framework. What of the recommendations could actually make a lot of traction here, do you think?
I think some of the specifics, like the government advertising recommendation that we've already talked about, actually could make a difference. I mean, that was a very concrete idea that the government itself could make happen if enough people were motivated to do that. The idea of greater transparency, which is one of the recommendations, would be both on the part of the government and government at all levels, and also on the part of media ownership. Right now, local television stations have to maintain a file that provides a lot of information about their activities and would allow members of the public to evaluate better the job that their local station is doing in serving them. Those files are kept in paper in the station. You have to go to the station to see them. The recommendation is that those be made available online, which would certainly allow for a lot more scrutiny. So that's something that's fairly easy to do. Some of the larger ones, like supporting nonprofit media and making sure that nonprofit media is more sustainable, those recommendations are a little more difficult to carry out. And there were a number of things: more philanthropic support, breaking down some of the regulatory barriers that have kept public media from succeeding as well as it might. Having the funding mechanism at the federal level be able to invest in innovation more, freeing that up a little more. Those are also things that really could happen. And, you know, I think it would be a mistake to underestimate the impact that that these recommendations could make.
And how realistic is it that some of those things would be able to happen, since they are agencies outside of the FCC that would be responsible for doing a lot of these things?
Well, you know, going back to this advertising dollar, that could be decided in the White House. I mean, if the, you know, the president, his cabinet, and others say, you know, their budgets have been improved and they want to do this because – and clearly the White House has a real focus on exactly what we're talking about, you know. There's, you know, one of the ones that's sort of in there under public media support is something that's being really – because of this report, because of these meetings and this discussion that's going on – is being raised to a higher level, and that is the nonprofit status of news organizations like KBIA and others.
The Missourian is actually incorporated as a nonprofit here in this
exactly.
community as
well. And in the bureaucracy of the IRS, they've begun looking at those and saying, wait a minute, it looks like a for-profit business, therefore it probably should be paying taxes. And that, you know, if in fact, you know, one of the things that the report states is, and I, you know, this is one of the controversy points is, you know, Steve sort of states we cannot depend on for-profit media to fill this news gap, and therefore it's real, the role of not-for-profit media is absolutely critical. So if all of a sudden not-for-profit news organizations are going to be forced to look and have the tax structure and some of the other pieces financial obligations that for-profits have, it probably would put them out of business. So that's a very specific item that came up kind of because of the study and the report. Going back to this comment about the report, one of the things I found fascinating, and I'm sure Steve might address this tomorrow when he's with us, everyone was disappointed with the report, which makes me feel like he probably did a good job, you know, because some people wanted him to come out and say, okay, here's what we should do for, blah, you know, for this thing, we should pass this law to do this, the FCC should do this, there's Congress can do this, the court should do that, you know, or whatever. We should incentivize, you know, all sorts of things, you know, like if you're a for-profit investor, you get a break, all those things. And then there are others who thought he went too far, you know, people say, oh my gosh, you know. So I think there's some of this is not in the purview of the federal government or the state or local government, which is, he states that government is not the answer. But he does point to things that policy related. So I think he did an amazing job of laying out a document that is in a way a blueprint, the first stage of, you know, maybe the first stage of some things. And without it all in one place, I don't think we are 5 years. I think we're going to look back and similar to what happened in the '60s when the Carnegie Foundation did a similar type of study. But I think the fact that everyone wasn't happy is probably a good sign.
Right. If I can just add, I think also there were a lot of people, especially journalists, who were very concerned about this when it was the idea of the government was going to do a study of journalism when this was proposed, because we have a First Amendment that says Congress shall make no law regarding a free press. And so if you have a government agency studying a free press, how, you know, what's going on here? But Steve is a lifelong journalist. He was an editor at Newsweek and U.S. News, and also the founder of a website called BeliefNet. So he knew traditional media, he knew new media, but his whole sensibility was as a journalist. And I remember talking to him when he first took on the job, and he said, you know, I'm very mindful of the First Amendment and very mindful that whatever government suggests, it can't be seen as intruding on the job of a free press in our society. So I think that's important too.
Okay. I want to get a couple of comments from our chat room. First, Debbie in the chat room says, if local media do not invest in quality employees who can produce quality work, then they cannot put out a quality product. If you invest $0, then your ROI will be the same. Agree? Disagree?
I know a lot of journalists who did not get into this line of work in order to get rich. So is the pay for journalists sometimes not what it might be in other professions? Yes. But I think the psychic rewards can be tremendous.
Yeah. But they have to get paid something. Right?
They do have to get paid something.
Right?
She's probably talking. And I think we've moved past kind of this concept of the citizen journalist, you know, media. And there are people still doing it. I mean, they're aggregating bloggers, you know, people, and they're calling that local news and things like that. But I do think that absolutely is not the future of quality, accountability journalism. And I should say, you know, sitting here at Missouri J School, I mean, we are having record numbers of applicants. This generation is coming in and seeing journalism as an important career. And we maybe haven't seen that for a while. Yeah. And to me, that makes me very optimistic. And going to Barbara's point, I mean, people want to learn a living, they want to have a career, but I think they see this is a place where a profession where you can make a difference. And I think it's critical that media entities then honor that and pay and engage.
Yeah. And the report does state very clearly that citizen journalists are not the answer, that you still have to have professionally trained journalists to do the job.
Just real fast, I'm going to combine a couple of questions here. Does the report view local online news websites as a solution for other media companies going out of business? Is that a viable thing?
It says they're not there yet. And one of the things that they talk about is how you can make nonprofit local websites more sustainable economically.
Yeah, but not as a replacement necessarily.
It's not a replacement now.
And it's interesting. I mean, TV and newspapers across the country are aggressively getting into the online business now. And I think that we're in this transition, and they're developing strategies on all market sizes to try to use online to fill some of the gap that they recognize.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time. That's all that we have today. Barbara Cochran, thank you for joining us. Also, Amy McCombs, thank you for joining us. And Renee Graham, also thanks for joining us today. We'd like to thank those of you in our audience for joining us too. And we'd like to remind you that those of you who are enjoying this as a rebroadcast, Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of our program, submit your questions and comments, and participate in an online chat with others in the audience. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Joe Deutschman. Ryan Femuliner is our audio producer today, and thanks again.